Good, good, good. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Tonight, we're going through Esther 6 and 7. I want to say greetings, we do, to all of you, and thank you for attending our Atlanta Bible study here on the Book of Esther. Book of Esther, of course, is a very exciting and reassuring book of the Bible. Though there are a lot of people who don't think so, and I'm not saying that they are Christian or not Christian. But God has given us to work through occasional problems. I think these are good lessons here when suffering for Christ. First, we're going to open in prayer, and I'm asking Dr. Philippos if he will open with prayer.
Yep, if you would bow your heads. Father in heaven, we come before your throne this evening, greatly appreciative of being able to come before you once more and to go into your word, go into your very thinking, and get a fuller sense of who you are and who you want us to be. We thank you for the opportunity to go through the book of Esther tonight once more. We thank you for the opportunity to come together. We pray that you'll allow the technology to work for the whether it be cooperative here in Atlanta, and at the same time for your Holy Spirit certainly to be poured out on your brethren, our speaker especially, but our hearing. Please help us to learn and to draw from the message tonight, even as you want us to. We thank you for this now. Pray for your spirit to be with all of your people wherever they may be listening. And you'll guide and direct everything we say and do, and it be to your glory. We ask this all now in Christ's name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you very much, Philip. Okay, we're going to go through a little background here first. Hopefully, all of you can hear me. There are, of course, a number of critics of Esther claiming that since God is not mentioned in Esther, the book is little more than history, and it is history, or a novel or novella. Sadly, they miss the spiritual application of God's providence that's embodied in the book of Esther, understood through their faith of and in God, and proven by the works of Esther and Mordecai. So I was looking at some of the scriptures here in Ephesians 2:10, which talks about faith and works. We prove our faith by our works. And that's what you'll find in the book of Esther, as we've already seen and will see again. James 2, verse 20, verse 22, verse 24, verse 26, all of the latter part of James chapter 2 speaks of faith proven by our works. So if you were to go to to James chapter 2, we used to call that in Ambassador College the Book of Faith. I've forgotten the name, the gentleman's name here. Well, I won't go through that. So the Book of Esther is full of good works that prove Esther and Mordecai's faith. I would like to turn, and I will, to 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 12 here at the beginning, because this pretty well speaks of what Mordecai and Esther went through, and it fits with us today. Beloved, 1 Peter 4, verse 12. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you. When I started out in a church, I thought if I had a trial, that was a strange thing. But if it had to do with the will of God and the way of God in my life, that wasn't a strange thing. But rejoice, verse 13, to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached, verse 14, for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part, he is blasphemed, but on your part, he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, or as a busybody in other people's matters. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, or her, but let him or her glorify God in this matter. For the time has come, as Peter writes, for judgment to begin at the house of God. That's a good thing. And if it begins with us first, what will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel of God? Verse 18, now if the righteous one, now if the righteous one is scarcely saved, where will the ungodly and the sinner appear? Finally, in verse 19, therefore let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to him in doing good as to a faithful creator. So I thought that these words were really helpful here, and I think that it helps explain and define what Esther and Mordecai went through. The name of the book, of course, is Esther, and her Jewish name was Hadassah, of course, if you should run into that and wonder about that. Chapter 3, I'm going to rehearse these chapters leading up to 6 and 7. In our recent studies of Esther, Mordecai, when we saw studies of Esther, we saw that King Xerxes, that's Ahasuerus, promoted Haman as a prime minister of all Persia. And he's identified as an Agagite of the Amalekites. That's where they come from. God says the Amalekites are the implacable enemies of Israel. God will pay them back at Christ's return. You see that in a number of places in the Old Testament, and I think you definitely see that in the minor prophets. God took advantage, excuse me, Haman took advantage of his position and attempted to destroy Mordecai and all the Jews in Persia, all because Mordecai would not fall down and worship him. When he drove by, chapter 4, Mordecai was made aware of Haman's lethal plan to annihilate the Jews. So he walked and wailed through Susa with sackcloth and ashes, showing his deep mourning over this. Missed this one a little bit. Esther had such respect for Mordecai, and she happened to be queen at the time, of course, that she immediately agreed with him when he advised her that she had to do something about it. She was a part of it, that God may have brought her to the crown and to the throne for this very time. And of course, he was right that she should approach the king, which was a very dangerous act to undertake, because the Gentile kings were ruthless, capricious, and if you weren't commanded to stand before them, if they didn't request you to come, and you came on your own, that was death. They would just kill you. So Esther said, if I die, I die. That's an easy phrase to remember. And so she shows total commitment to God. Very important here. Chapter 5 reveals the imminent death for the godly Queen Esther. She didn't die, of course, there. She was wise, having had a converted Mordecai as her mentor. They were cousins. Mordecai was much older than Esther. And especially during early years when her future was shaped by God through Mordecai. I'm not going to argue the point of whether she was 14 or 15 or 20. I would think she was probably closer to 18, 19, or 20 when she was brought before the king and chosen by him to become king. So she stood in the inner court of the king's palace where the king could see her. We normally look at a building having doors like we know about today, but the throne room where the king was is the most likely location within a royal palace, and it was designed for the king to have an unimpeded view to the court, palace court, and other areas. And it was raised a little bit as well. They knew what they were doing, and so they could the king could see out from his throne room. God gave her, we're still in chapter 5, God gave her favor with the king. Esther was received by the king, and he remembered his beautiful wife, Queen Esther. And for her to come, he had to think she must have something very important to share, or she wouldn't have risked her life to appear before him. This is in chapter 5. The king then offered her one half of the entire kingdom. Esther, at that point, didn't expose Haman at this meeting. Instead, she asked to prepare a banquet for the king and Haman. Very wise thing to do. She didn't play her cards right away. She held them. So now tonight we're going into Esther chapter 6. And we will continue our study in 6 and 7. Here we see Mordecai honored by the king of Persia. And finally, and I'm getting ahead of myself, it's a bit of a quantum leap, Haman is actually hung on a tree. Esther 6. Let me get that here in my on the line here. That night in chapter 6, the king could not sleep. Here's one of these things I think in the book of Esther is providential, that God had a hand in this. The night, that particular night, the king could not sleep. So one was commanded, a particular person, a chamberlain, a eunuch, whomever it might be, was commanded by the king, bring to him the book of the records of the Chronicles. They kept everything. They wrote everything down. And they were read before the king. So for whatever reason, he wanted to hear them. I think it has something to do, of course, with God and what God was doing with Esther and with Mordecai and with the Jews scattered throughout the 127 provinces of Persia. Verse 2, and it was found written in those chronicles that were read to him that Mordecai had told of Bigthana or Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. That's just a nice way of saying they were planning to assassinate the king, which happened often in the Gentile kingdoms. It even happened, of course, in Israel and in Judah. Verse 3, then the king said, after he had heard this read to him by the individual who read it, of course, and the story that was written in detail, apparently, about these two individuals who were trying to assassinate the king. Then the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. Let me go to my notes here. The king asked what honor had been paid to Mordecai for this. The king's servants, plural, more than one, responded, as we read, nothing's been done for him. This was an oversight, and this oversight disturbs Xerxes, Xerxes, another name for Ahasuerus, and it reflected on him as king of the Persians for not rewarding one of his benefactors. And I don't know if you heard of Herodotus. He's a famous Greek historian. Some say that he was the father of history. I have no way of proving that, but I know that we had to study him a little bit in Ambassador College in one of the classes that we took. I think it was had to do with the history of Israel. But the Greek historian Herodotus indicated it was a point of honor with Persian kings to promptly and generously reward those who had befitted them. So he acted immediately. You'll find this, of course, if you're looking for a little bit of data on it, is Expositor's Bible Commentary, Volume 4, page 822. I redacted it and I put it in the vernacular, but it means the same. Verses 4 and 5. So the king said, who is in the court? Now you got to consider the king was in his bedchamber that was nearby the throne room. And here it was in the middle of the night, and he's asking who is in the court, which, of course, if he were on the throne, he'd be able to see who was in the court. Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. If you do a little bit of research, you'll find out gallows is not the same thing that we see in movies in the West, where they had gallows and they had a crossbeam and they hung people. It's not what they're talking about here. They didn't go to all that trouble. It wasn't even invented in that time. What they did do is they took a tree and they shaved it. Don't want to gross anyone out. And it was for impaling. So they wanted to hang Mordecai on this impaling tree that he had prepared for him. And it was near his home, of all things. So the king asked someone, I'm reading my notes, is in the court of the king's palace, close to the throne room and apparently close to the bedchamber. And the king's servants told him that Haman was in there. He was standing in the court. Now, this would seem strange. I have a parenthetical insert here. That would seem strange at this time of night, except that Haman was consumed with the thought of pressing the king to hang Mordecai for his refusal to fall down and worship him. Because after all, he had the backing of the king. And certainly they would fall down, others would fall down and worship the king when he passed by. Haman expected the same thing. He was prime minister, he had a great deal of power. Mordecai wouldn't do it. So the king said, when they told him that Haman was out in the outer court, let him come in. So the question I have here is, was this providential? Let's go to verse 6. So Haman came in. And of course, he's very much pumped in what he has done and thinks he has all the power in the world. And he's got the favor of the king, and he can do just exactly what he wants to do, and the king will back him. So Haman came in, and the king asked him. There's no hello, how are you? He just got right to the subject because, after all, he had heard the reading of the Chronicles, and he had realized, understood that Mordecai had never been honored in any way whatsoever. So he asked this, in a sense, a rhetorical question: what shall be done, verse 6, for the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? That's what happens when you let human nature take hold. That's what happens, as they say, be careful what you wish for, you may just get it. So the mind is powerful, and he thought that the king was speaking of him. And Haman answered the king, here is my opportunity. I'm sure he must be talking about me. So I am going to give him the best that I possibly can. I'm going to look great in all of this. For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought in, which the king has worn. That's remarkable. That's asking for a lot. And a horse, I'm going to add, be brought in, on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Now, among the Gentiles, it was not unusual for the king and his steed to be honored. And a royal crest was placed on the head of the horse that the king was riding. So that wasn't unusual. Haman certainly knew it. And he thought, this is really going to make me look great. Verse 9, then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes. That's a ruler, that he may array the man. He's going to dress him up, whom the king delights to honor. Still not done. Then parade him on the horseback. This is remarkable that he would think all of this through. Parade him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him this man who's riding on the king's horse and having the king's robe on him. Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Again, he still had this attitude that it was all about him. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, make haste, don't wait. Take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai, the Jew, who sits within the king's gate, leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken. It's interesting here in verse 10 that he knew that Mordecai was a Jew, and it wasn't unusual in Susa, one of the four capital cities. Wasn't unusual for Jews to be in those cities, of course. And it wasn't unusual for Jews to be scattered throughout the 127 provinces. But here he identifies Mordecai as the Jew who sits within the king's gate. So he was trusted for him to be able to be there, be able to answer questions, direct people, and have access to other people who even get as close as possible to the king. Leave nothing undone, which I've already read, of all that you have spoken. So Haman took the robe. I'm wondering right now if, in my mind, was his hand shaking? He took the robe and the horse. He arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, "Thus shall it be, shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Boy, that had to grate him deeply. That was hard for him to take, because Haman was the enemy of Mordecai and Esther and the Jews. But suddenly, the enemy becomes the victim. He's going to have a big problem here. So that was tough for him to take. Verse 12. Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate. I like the way that this is laid out here. It's very possible that Mordecai had a big hand in writing Esther. It wouldn't surprise me at all. With all the research I've read on it, the disclaimers as to who actually wrote it could not have been Mordecai for different reasons. He was a Jew. Why would they let him write it? And so on. But Mordecai went back to the king's gate. So he was still humble. He wasn't proud of himself. He didn't say, "Well, let me see if I can get close to the gate. I'll do whatever, excuse me, as close to the throne as I possibly can." You don't see that. But Haman, at the same time, hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. I wrote here something that was brought to my attention. At least I thought so when I did a little more research on this. That he may have had what we call a hoodie, anything that he possibly could have to cover his head. He might have been crying. He was certainly might have been swearing. He was probably shaking his head. His head was covered. He didn't want anyone to be able to see his displeasure, what he had to go through. It was just so humiliating. So we're in now 13. When Haman told his wife, Zeresh, unusual name, but common then, and all his friends, so he had friends around and in the house, everything that had happened to him, his wise men, so apparently among those friends, there were some wise men, and his wife, Zeresh, said to him, "If," which is conditional, "Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent," I would add parenthetically, as has been said here, as we have heard, "you will not prevail against him, but you will surely fall before him." While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came. Those are chamberlains. They were not necessarily in Persia. If you look it up, you'll find this to be true, that they were all eunuchs, as eunuchs were considered to be, so that they could take care of the concubines of the king. But eunuchs were also considered to be chamberlains of the king, and they were normal human beings, but they were well-trusted. So the king's eunuchs came, and they hurried to bring Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So, while his wife and friends were discussing Haman's humiliation, the king's chamberlains hurried to bring Haman to Esther's banquet. Well, we're doing pretty well. We only have done 25 minutes. Let's go to chapter 7, unless you have some questions. I'm not looking at the Q&A, so.
Yeah, so I don't see any questions. I posted the article you wrote on Profiles in Faith on Esther in case anyone wants to reference it, but there were no other questions right now about Esther.
Okay, very good. So, well, let's continue in chapter 7. So the king and Haman went to dine with Queen Esther, not on that night, of course. Probably the next day would be my guess. You got some time difficulties here, and you'll find the researchers, theologians, professors of theology, and so on will have all kinds of ideas about, well, this can't be right because they didn't have the time setting properly set up, and it's not clear to us. I'm just taking it at face value here. And on the second day at the banquet of wine, so here it was not unusual for the Gentile kings to have banquets of wine. It's not also unusual that they would be drinking out of those same gold cups that came from Jerusalem that Nebuchadnezzar had taken with him from Jerusalem after he had razed Jerusalem. And killed a lot of people and brought Daniel and the royal people and a king or two to Babylon. So it wasn't unusual for once the Persians to have conquered, once they conquered Babylon, to take those same goblets, those same drinking containers. So they had this banquet of wine and they were drinking out of gold cups. The king said to Esther, "What is your petition, Queen Esther?" Because all she had said was, "I want to prepare a banquet for you and Haman." Which the king says, "Yeah, this is great. Sounds great. How about it, Haman?" And Haman at the time said, "Oh, this is wonderful." He just could not believe it. But now you're in the second day at the banquet of wine. So that's not to say they didn't have other food or other food to be able to eat, along with the wine, but it was primarily focusing on their different wines. And in Persia, when the king had a banquet of wine, not all the time, but a lot of the time, you had to drink as much as the king drank. At this particular time, I think we're going to find that the king said, "You can drink as much as you want or as little as you want." But in the meantime, the king said to Esther, I want to give you a little background on the banquet of wine. "What is your petition, Queen Esther?" That tells me there might be a little bit of wine working here. "It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Up to half the kingdom?" I'm adding here, I'm telling you, it shall be done. Guaranteed it'll be done. If you want half the kingdom. Now, you take people out here in the world offered that, they'd take him up on that. "Okay, I'll take half the kingdom." "I don't care which half, just give me half of it." Because you've got taxation, tributes, you're going to have a lot of money, you're going to have a lot of people looking up to you, you're going to have a lot of accolade, you're going to get used to it, you're going to love it. So most people would say, "I'll take half the kingdom." Then Queen Esther answered and said, verse 3, "Here's the wisdom that came down from Mordecai in the mind and in the heart of Esther." Cousins, so they were. He was much older and he took her into his home as her father. He wasn't her father. Treated her as if he were his father. He wanted to take good care of her. So here's what she said. And when I see this, I think of Mordecai, who taught Queen Esther. "If I have found favor in your sight, O king," wonderful way to begin here, "and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition or my request, and my people at my request." You can add petition. Now, suddenly, instead of half the kingdom, she's asking if he'll just save her life and if he will just save the lives of the Jews. Now, Here we go indirectly. It's implied, as far as the scripture is concerned, that she is saying, I'm a Jewess. I'm a Jew. Because my people are about to be destroyed. Verse 4, for we have been sold. We'll touch on that a little bit. Make sure that I get into this here, because I want to read some things here that might be a little surprising to you. I don't know. For we have been sold, she said. She's absolutely correct. My people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Not one Jew left. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I wouldn't have said anything to you. I would have held my tongue. Although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. What does that mean? Well, she changes the story a little bit and says to him, this is becoming economical as well. You would lose a great deal of income. You'd lose tribute. You'd lose taxation. You would lose whatever the Jews possess. They're worth some money. They can make money for you. And so the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. Okay, here's what I want to get into here. Consider Haman's, you remember that Haman had offered the total income, excuse me, I had offered the king 10,000 talents. You might say, big deal, what's that got to do with me? But of course, she was alluding to the king's economic losses. Consider Haman's offer, the total income for Persia at that time, you can look it up, was approximately, they say exactly 14,000, so there must be a record of this, 560 talents. And that, according to Greek historian Herodotus, book number 3, number 95. I looked it up. You can look it up. It's there. That's what was coming in to the hands or the treasury of the king in Persia, 14,560 talents. Now, since, and before I get into the worth of that, since he, the king, tried like everything to conquer Greece, he wasn't able to do it. Tried more than once. He had to tuck his tail and run back home because he couldn't overcome him. That probably reduced his wealth. So when Queen Esther says that the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss, he's going to lose a lot more than the enemy. She's going to identify the enemy here in a little bit. And I can just see the sweat pouring down on the brow of Haman about this time. Since he failed to conquer Greece, that is Xerxes or Ahasuerus, he likely reduced his wealth. Makes sense. So replenishing his treasury appealed to him. Makes sense again. Although Haman's offer to the king was 10,000 talents, and it was great, he might have factored in the potential plundering of the Jews, which is to say, it's possible that he didn't have the entire 10,000 talents, but he was going to be able to round it up for the king. Maybe he did. If he didn't, and he could, after plundering the Jews, killing them all, he would be able to take what they have and add to his talents. Just how much, got to ask this question, would this offer be in today's U.S. dollars? Okay, to assume a talent of silver to be 375 tons, that sounds outrageous. That's what they're saying. And 29,000 in research, 29,166 ounces make up a ton of silver. Then at $20.69 an ounce in modern U.S. dollars, that equals over, you ready? Tighten your seatbelt, $226 million U.S. dollars. So I wrote here, the king had considered his offer. So that was a lot of wealth coming the king's way to pay for the king to sign into law that they would kill all of the Jews. 226 million over that in US dollars today. Now let's go back to Esther's plea. So, verse 5, the king was no dummy. Incidentally, I looked it up and I'm not sure this is the case, but there are a number of researchers who said that the king, this has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but to give an idea of what he looked like, that he may have been somewhere near 8 feet tall. That sounds strange to me. So maybe someone says he was as high as 6 feet two. Someone else says, no, he's closer to 8 feet tall. Goliath was over 9 feet or 10. So King Ahasuerus, now we're in verse 5, answered and said to Queen Esther, he is computing all of this in his mind. He's listening carefully to what Esther was telling him. She was explaining the details he didn't know about. Who is he and where is he who would dare to presume in his heart to do such a thing? So she did not wait when she was talking a little bit earlier, which I didn't say. This plays into it. In verse 3, after she asked for her life to be spared and her people to be spared, she didn't wait for him to answer. You'll notice that. She went right into the fact as to what had happened by the hand and the mind, the wicked mind of Haman. Now let's go down here to verse 5. I already read, who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? Here's the opportunity that Esther had. Now you got to understand that the Gentile kings were often capricious, they were sensual, they were rash, and they could be really wicked. They could take lives, didn't bother them a bit. So here she is. She has the docket. She says, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman, probably pointed to him. So Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. I would guess the king would have a quick shot, his eyeballs on Haman, and the queen already was pointing to him. So her eyes were on Haman. He had to be terrified. This was terrible. Then the king arose in his anger from the banquet of wine, and he went into the palace garden. Beautiful garden. Pretty big, too, if you do a little bit of research on it. It's beautiful, well taken care of. And there are a number of thoughts as to why he went into the palace garden. One was he just signed that law that would kill all of the Jews, and it was at the hand of Haman. He had listened to Haman. He had believed in Haman. He had trusted Haman. So he'd have to think through that. And he'd also have to think, my beautiful Queen Esther is begging for her life. She's not asking for a half of the kingdom. She's begging for her life. I have got to work through this. And he went into the palace garden, but Haman did not follow him and beg for his life. He stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life. And he was so torn up and so desperate because he saw that evils were determined against him by the king. He knew how the king could act. When the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman, in his fear and being so terrified, had either tripped or begged. He had fallen across the couch where Esther was. She had probably reclined, which they did in Old Testament times on a couch. Jesus did. John laid his hand on the chest of Jesus, and they were relaxed. That's not unusual. And Haman had fallen across the couch begging Esther. Then the king came in and said, will he, meaning Haman, didn't even mention his name, also assault the queen while I am in the house? You got two choices here to use for the word assault. either molest or rape while I am in the house. As the word left the king's mouth, verse 8, they covered Haman's face. So that was the end, going to be the end of Haman. Covered his face. What did they use? Well, he could have easily used a cloth, a rug of some sort. I don't know, it'd have to be flexible enough, or just their hands. Covered Haman's face. That's a terrible place to be in. Now, Harbona, who is named one of the eunuchs, so he was someone, if Mordecai wrote this, would remember Harbona, he would know about Harbona, said to the king, look, the gallows, still daylight, 50 cubits high. Boy, that'd be awfully high. There's a lot of argument on among the researchers whether 50 cubits high was actually the height of the gallows or not. But just say the height of a tree, whatever that tree was. And the gallows was the carving down of the central part of the tree to be nothing less than an impaling stake. So it was very high. Why would they say that? So that everybody in the Susa could walk by and see who was on it. I think that'd be difficult to look at. Which Haman made for Mordecai, verse 9 yet, who spoke good on the king's behalf. This is Harbona saying this, so he knew about the Chronicles. Whether he was the one that read that to the king, I don't know. But he had to know about it. Who spoke good on the king's behalf, so he knew what was in the Chronicles and what Mordecai had done, is standing. That gallows is standing at the house of Haman. King didn't even hesitate. Hang him on it. Not only was somebody impaled on that, they did it to shame that particular person. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's wrath was subsided. Let me go to my notes here for just a moment. Wow, I got here through here a little faster than I thought he would. And I want to read from Job 5, verses 12 through 13, where God's word says, he frustrates, that's God, thinking about Haman here, the devices of the crafty, so that their hands cannot carry out their plans. Next verse, verse 13, he catches the wise in their own craftiness, and the counsel of the cunning comes quickly upon them. So it's reversed, just as it did with Haman. So they hanged Haman on the very gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. Had to be a terrible thing. His family saw it. You have to ask, when you go back through these chapters, that when Zeresh, the wife of Haman, actually gave him advice on how to take care of Mordecai, that when Haman came back, it was very convenient for her to say, you're a dead man. How do you do that? That was his wife. But she said both. And so she switched horses right in the middle of the stream and said, you're a dead man. So we are at the end of chapter 7. Esther 6 and 7, giving a brief summary, reveals how faithful saints show by their works their love and reverence for God and his holy will. And they do it with an enduring quality. They are persevering. They don't quit. Patient endurance. Now, Esther can also be a type of the New Testament church, in a sense, that relates with Matthew 24, 22. Because if it hadn't been for Esther and Mordecai, but Queen Esther, who said, if I die, I die, put her life on the line, and was faithful to God and never turned away from God and said, whatever happens, happens. I'm going before the king. It can kill me easily. In Matthew 24:22, I'm rehearsing again. Esther can be a type of the New Testament church, but for the elect's sake, those days of the great tribulation will be shortened. So if there were no elect, and I said before, it's unfortunate that they use the word elect. It should be select, because in John 6:44 and 65, God does the calling. He selects the saints to be. They're not elected by a bunch of other people. Those days shall of the great tribulation, I'm adding that, will be shortened. If they weren't shortened, everyone on earth would be dead. Moffat has it correct when he says no flesh shall be saved, and he adds the word alive, which is the implication on earth. You're going to have bodies around the earth, all of them dead. But that's not what God is talking about. Christ is saying there would be none alive if it weren't for, that's right, you and me. If it weren't for the New Testament church, if it weren't for those faithful saints who said, if I die, I die, who are committed totally to God. And that's what's going to happen in the very end time. Now, we have, of course, the New Testament church that it is today. But when you look at Revelation 3, you see the Philadelphian attitude and the Laodicean attitude. I don't know if you've done any studies on either one of those. I would recommend it. And you have to be really cautious and careful. And when you do your research to find out what Christ is actually saying about each one of those attitudes. The Philadelphian attitude, Philadelphia has to do with brotherly love, which is the second great commandment, that we should love our neighbor as we love ourselves. So all our brethren, we must love them. And if we love them, truly love them, then the first great commandment has already been taken care of. You can't do that second commandment if you don't have that first great commandment. And that's to love God with all your heart, your soul, your mind. I believe, and I don't have it down here, I think you find that in Matthew 22 toward the end of the chapter. So this is why I say that the select's sake, those days are going to be short, because you've got people like Esther who are going to stand up and be counted, who are not going to take things in their own hand, under their own power, in their own hand, who are not going to say, well, this is the way I look at it. We don't look at it that way. If we are saints of God, we look at it as God wants us to look at it, his way. We have two choices, but there's only one right choice. And this is what I think is so important about the book of Esther. The name of God you do not find in the book of Esther. However, the conduct of Esther and Mordecai show that they had God in mind, or they wouldn't have done what they did. So God very much had something to do with Esther and Mordecai. Okay, it's 7:48 by my time. Are there any questions or comments, or do you want me to go on to 8? I haven't prepared for it necessarily.
I'm going to leave it to you, and then at 7:49, there is a comment from Jennifer. She quotes Proverbs 26:27.
Yeah.
If you set a trap for others, you'll be caught in that trap.
Beautiful.
Which she, offers good scriptural support for what we've been dealing with.
Thank you.
And then Michael Ciotti notes this. I'm curious as to whether Esther and Daniel overlap. And then he goes on. Xerxes, a.k.a. Hazarus, was the son of Darius the First. Were the two books contiguous, even though Esther appears in the Bible before Daniel?
Esther's, okay, the answer is, that'd be hard to put them together. Daniel was taken out by Nebuchadnezzar from Jerusalem. And I believe it was that he, if we look at the scripture carefully, I don't have it in front of me. Very good question. That he was taken out and he was part of royalty. The king was taken. A number of the royal people were taken. That was in 605 BC. What we see with King Ahasuerus, he ruled from, if I got this right, 484 BC to 460. It's either 485 or 484 to 465.
So
I thought he ruled.
I
Go
had
ahead.
from Ambassador College days 485 to 465 BC is
Okay,
when
it's 20
searching for.
years. Right. So Daniel would predate him. However, Daniel lived a long life because even the queen mother said to Belshazzar, I hope I have his name correct in Daniel. You've done a good job on Daniel, Philip. So you will remember that there's a man who knows when there was a handwriting on the wall. He could probably come and interpret that. And they brought him in, and that was a much older Daniel. If that were in 539, which is when Babylon took the heat, and I think it was on the Feast of Trumpets, which is very interesting when you read it in Josephus. I want to add a lot of stuff, but to me, this is interesting stuff. This is eye candy and ear candy and taste candy for me. And so, if that's the case, and he was, say, 17 or 18 in 605. Well, how old was he in 539? Plus, Darius or Darius, and there's some argument as to who he was. Some say it was another name for King Cyrus, because King Cyrus was the great king. But anyway, he used Daniel apparently as a prime minister. So he still was older. That would make him what? In 39, 40, that's 65, and then you add, even if he were 15, that would be what, 80? So he was over 80 years of age in about 539. And she came a little later, even if she were 18 or 19 when she married the king, which was probably 3 years into his reign. No, they couldn't be simultaneous. I hope that helps. I'm trying to pick that up from research, I remember.
Yep, I had the exact same number you did.
Okay, good.
So if you want to, there are no other comments or questions right now. If you have additional comments or questions, please don't hesitate to post. We could go into one more chapter and then call it after what? Esther 8,
Okay.
if you want to.
Oh, I don't mind doing it if that's okay with you guys.
Yes, sir, you're on.
On that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther, not unusual for this to take place, the house of Haman. That is all of his wealth, everything that he had. And he must have been worth some money. The enemy of the Jews, of course. And Mordecai came before the king, where Esther had told how he was related to her. So came before the king, shows that he was accepted by the king, very likely requested by the king to come before him. So the king, verse 2, so the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. Well, now Haman was PM, prime minister. So if he's doing this, he's making Mordecai PM, prime minister. And Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman. She was queen. She could do that. Now Esther spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet. What an attitude of this young lady. And implored him with tears, well, she wasn't so young then, I guess, to counteract the evil of Haman, the Agagite, and the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. If I'm not mistaken, I think Agag was a king of the Amalekites. And the Amalekites are considered, as I mentioned earlier, which I pulled from one of the commentaries, the implacable enemies. You couldn't reason with them against Israel, which God's going to take care of in the future, of course, hasn't done it fully yet. Does say he'll do it. And the scheme which he had devised against the Jews. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. Whoever's writing this knows what went on in Susa, knows what went on in the throne room. He'd been there. So the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther, which means come forward. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, if it pleases the king, and if I found favor in his sight, I love her attitude, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of, oh boy, this got every letter in the alphabet here, Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. Now, at the risk of saying this over and over, the law of the Medes and the Persians took place before Ahasuerus used it, or the kings before him. So that wasn't new, but she knew about it. And she knew once that was written, they could not revoke it. So what are you going to do to protect the Jews who can't protect themselves? For how can I endure? She's still petitioning the king to see the evil that will come to my people. Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they've hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves, he's talking to Queen Esther and Mordecai, you yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews, just as you please, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring, which he'd already given, right? He'd taken it away from Haman. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke. I one time did a little bit of research on the signet rings of Gentile kings. It's amazing that when an important missive was written that was going to be sent to another king, they had an envelope, however that was developed, whatever it was written, however it was developed and constructed. Then they'd fold it over, and then they had this hot wax used. They showed it when I looked at it as a red in color. And then the king's signet would be imprinted on that wax, and it would stay there. If that were ever touched by anyone in any way, and they could somehow determine by that wax and the signet ring imprinted on it, they would kill those people immediately. And the people knew it. The guy who's running it on a horse or on steeds across country, and like the Pony Express going from one to another to get to somewhere else, no one's going to be able to revoke that. So the king's scribes, verse 9, were called at that time in the third month, which is a month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps or satraps, who were probably anywhere from 22 to 28, and all of the provinces were under them, the governors and the princes, the rulers of the provinces. And here's about the only place that shows the extension of the Persian Empire in King Ahasuerus' day, from India to Ethiopia. If you like geography, you'd look that up. If you don't, you can still look it up. And it's a very big area. 127 provinces in all kinds of people of all kinds of languages, to every people in their own language, and to the Jews in their own script and language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus. Who is he? Well, I have to go back here. The king's scribes were called, and it was written, but it says he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with it. That was almost like Mordecai, but I don't see the, what do you call it when you go back to the person and you relate the two? Starts with an A, forgotten it. He wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus, sealed it with the king's signet ring, and sent letters by couriers on horseback, riding on royal horses bred from swift steeds. I don't know if you like horses. One of my favorite movies was Seabiscuit. Pretty fast, smaller horse, had a big heart, didn't want to lose. These royal horses were bred from swift steeds, probably Arabian horses. By these letters, the king permitted, here's what was written, the Jews who were in every city to gather together and protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of any people or province that would assault them, both little children and women, and to plunder their possessions. So there was not going to be any mercy shown the Jews. So the way to offset this was to have another law of the Medes and Persians that said that the Jews can equip themselves and do battle and fight, save their own lives, their families' lives, their children's lives, and destroy those who come against them. On one day in all the provinces, I'm breaking into the thought, and to plunder their possessions on one day in all of his provinces of King Ahasuerus, 13th day of the 12th month, which is a month of Adar. If I'm not mistaken, I think that's the month before Passover, Nisan, for the Jews. Could be wrong, but I think that's the case. I looked it up, did my study on it, but I don't have my inspired notes beside me. My bad. But that's kind of bringing that to mind anyway. It's a copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province, published for all people so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. This is where you get the Festival of Purim. The couriers who rode on royal horses went out. They hurried and pressed on by the king's command, and the decree was issued in Shushan at Susa, the citadel. So Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in a royal apparel, or in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. Purple has to do with royalty, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. Made him prime minister immediately beneath the king. Of course, the queen had great power, the wife of the king. So the Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them. Make me a Jew because I want to be with them. I'm with you. That many of the people of the land became Jews because of that. And a great feast and a holiday had to do with the feast that we understand today as Purim. I've forgotten the quote of one rabbi who said, Purim is when we, yeah, the Purim is when we ask God to protect us and take care of us. Passover, the next month, is when God asks us to follow him and do his will. Something to that effect. They said it better than what I did. Okay, it's 8:03. Any thoughts or any questions or any comments?
I don't have anything more.
Okay. Well, all we have is chapter 9 and then a very brief chapter 10. So we can
You
wait
wanna?
for next. What do you
Yeah,
want to do?
let's hold till next time and let's conclude, if you will,
Continue.
next time.
All right, that sounds great. We'll do Esther 9 and 10 next week with if that's fine with you.
Yep. If you will, in case anyone has questions, we may knock off a little early. You may have
Yeah.
thoughts.
Me
Yes.
or them?
Yes.
Well, I just think this book of Esther is incredible, and I was amazed, truly amazed. at how many people have fought against Esther being canonized in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Amazing. And they'll use all kinds of rationale, all kinds of reasoning. They will say that Esther was a Jew. If she were so faithful, why in the world would she give herself to become to be married to a Gentile king? Somebody forgot about the book of Ruth, who was Gentile and married an Israelite. Isn't that interesting? And how about Daniel, who worked for the king of Babylon, who, as I understand it, was actually head of the great library in Susa in Babylon? Joseph became the prime minister of Egypt. They're all Gentile. So for people to bring these things up shows me they're not thinking too clearly, or they have they're anti-Semitic, or they just don't want to be a part of Israel. What they don't know is that they're all going to have to become spiritual Israelites, or you can't enter into the heavenly Jerusalem, as Revelation 22, verse 14 makes very, very clear. You got to go through one of those 12 gates in heavenly Jerusalem. You've got to be a spiritual Israelite because all 12 gates have the names of all 12 tribes of Israel. So you must be a spiritual Israelite to be able to come in there. These people who fight against whether Esther could become, I'm going back to it, Esther should be canonized or not. I think Ezra had a good deal to do with that as well, because Ezra came on a little bit later. I did read where Esther probably died as a queen and probably outlasted the king, King Ahasuerus. That's very possible. I also read, and I thought this was interesting, that Queen Vashti, going all the way back, you remember, to Esther chapter 1,
Yes.
Vashti, a very beautiful woman, that they believe that she had another name, either in, I think it was in Persia, may have been before Persia, may have been in Babylon. And in the annals of the kings, I think it's in Persia, that there was another name that would fit for Queen Vashti, who turned out to be a pretty cruel woman on her own, because of the offset of Queen Vashti was this other lady's name whose name began with A. I've forgotten her name. I would guess on it, but I would miss on it. And that woman was a cruel person, and Ashley, Queen Vashti may have become, if she lived, having stood against the king. That's doubtful if she lived, but if she lived, she could be that queen mother, as it were, who killed others under kings in Persia later on. Not sure about that, but of course they're coming up with all kinds of things. Little bit of additional stuff that you can't necessarily take that to your favorite coffee shop. Get a free coffee.
No extra charge.
No extra charge for that.
So I
But there
think that
was, yes, go ahead.
I don't see any additional comments. I will share that I was at one point to get a visual of Esther and the king. I threw up a couple of graphics if anyone wanted to look at them, but that
Oh,
was
that would be good.
just additional information. So.
Yeah. You know, I think it's interesting, and we don't necessarily want to go here, but the kings, it was not unusual for a Gentile king to have concubines,
Right.
for they had a number of women. And so it was not unusual that that king would have Queen Vashti as his wife, and she was queen, and then shortly after have Esther as the queen of Persia. And it's not unusual.
Time Dr. Whitlow felt the ground shifting beneath.
And it's not unusual. It's not unusual for Queen Esther to have not been in the king's throne room all the time. Mm-hmm. She, because at one point it was 30 days that she was not seen by the king, which made her a little bit nervous when she had to go before him. So there are these other things that fit within the overall imagery of Queen Esther, who was quite a lady and very wise. And the big thing about Queen Esther and Mordecai, but especially Queen Esther, she could have died in a heartbeat. The king could have taken her life in a heartbeat. And she knew that. She knew how he acted. She knew the culture of the Persians. She knew what the kings would do. She had to. She could read the Chronicles if she wanted to, I would guess. And for her to go through and then finally say, I think this is a phrase that we should remember. If I die, I die.
Mm-hmm.
How many people will do that? How many people would do that? So it speaks really highly of Queen Esther. Okay, it's 8:11, but we still don't have any questions.
Nope, we can regroup next Tuesday evening at Esther 9 and 10.
Sounds good.
And we'll wrap it up then.
Sounds great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
Night, everyone. Great
night. Have a great week and a great Sabbath.
Thank you.
You too.